This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry, back here with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Recording after the close today, March 10th. We're live on the Twitter Spaces again. Looks like we got a bunch of people listening, so that's nice to see. It's March Madness time, and not only in the markets.
Yeah, right, definitely.
Sam, yeah, I was going to say our hometown UCLA Bruins were cruising to a possible one seed, only for an injury to potentially derail their the season, and hopefully that's not an apt metaphor for markets these days.
Definitely a lot going on in the on the telly right now, you know, both in sports land and then in financial markets. So
yeah, why don't we take a look at where are we and then get into the behind the scenes of what was going on.
Yeah, so where we are in markets this week, looking at it, it's pretty bloody out there for risk assets. Starting with the S&P 500 down 4.5 on the week, trimming the positive number for the year to date down to just under 1% positive performance for the year to date on the S&P 500. Across the board, all 11 sectors of the S&P 500 down on the week. Consumer staples, the best performer, but down 1.9%. Looking at the worst, no surprise, it's financials this week, down 8.5%. Digging down, giving a little sneak peek towards our topic of the week here, looking at perhaps the main culprit here, looking at the S&P Regional Bank Index, it's down 15.5% on this week alone, bringing that index fully negative for the year-to-date, down over 13% for the year-to-date basis. This impacting the small cap stocks as well. We're seeing small cap as measured by the Russell 2000 down over 8% on the week, Russell 1000 down 5%. Moving over to fixed income, a bit of a tailwind on the news of the week here with the 2-year treasury yield closing the week at 4.58. I saw it got as high as 5.07% yield on the 2-year treasury note on Wednesday. So a really big shift down in just a matter of 2 days versus that 507 close that we had there. So on the week-to-date basis, however, the 2-year treasury yield is in by 28 basis points. Moving across the treasury curve there, the 10 and the 30-year have an exactly the same closing yield today at 3.68. That's 27 basis points lower on the yield for the 10-year, 19 basis points lower for the bond. And what this meant.
That was an interesting, Sam, that you know, today certainly looked a little hairy, but kind of looking at the week, you know, the 2-year and the 10-year both rallied by the same amount. So you didn't have any, no flattener or steepener. It was just a pure bull market in bonds.
Yeah, that's right. But it was interesting. Now that you mentioned the 2s-10 spread there, that got over 100 basis points inverted at one point during the week there. So that was interesting to see. Right alongside there with the 3-month 10-year, which closed the week at inverted by 1.27%, it looks like here. So the full-on rally you said in bonds largely took place within the interest rate sensitive portion of the market. Looking at the
Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate, that was up by 1% on the week, led by U.S. Treasuries at up 1.7%, agency mortgage-backed securities up 80 basis points, and IG corporate credit up by 60 basis points on the week. When you look at the sectors outside of the bond aggregate, though, you get the other way around, bro. So the risk assets, riskier assets there, with high yield corporate credit down 1.7% and bank loans down by 80 basis points. So definitely following on the heels of the S&P 500 and other risk markets there. Similarly, we look at the Bloomberg Commodity Index. It was down 3.4% on the broad basket of commodities, making it down for the year at 6.5%. Looking at WTI front month futures contract, that was down just about 4% on the week-to-date basis, but it's still maintaining kind of that $76 a barrel of WTI crude oil there. When we look at gold, gold got a little bit of a rally on some of this weakness in risk asset, riskier assets there. It's up 1%, closing the week at $1,870 a troy ounce. And then over to Bitcoin. We always talk about this as a little bit of perhaps the U.S. equity market, perhaps the NASDAQ 100 on leverage. That was down 10% on a week-to-date basis, dropping below $20,000 of Bitcoin for the week here. So with that wrap-up in markets, Jeff, do you want to kick us off on some of the things that happened in macro land this week?
Sure, Sam. On Wednesday, we did get the JOLTS job openings data came out. That number came out at 10.8 million, was expected to be about 10.5, so slightly higher than expectations. Mark Kimbrough, who put this together before he went on vacation today, did say that, this is not really what Jay Powell, or all in all, Powell can't be pleased with these numbers. We also have the quits rate dropping very slightly from 2.6 to 2.5. So that's indicative of a kind of a pretty tight labor market. We did also get, I kind of highlighted here, we did get the, Sam, one of the things we were talking about maybe being the topic of the week was this Challenger job cuts announcement number that was up 410% year over year. It was actually a little bit less than the 440% expectations, but really when you're looking at it, we couldn't really find any information about how this data is compiled. So similarly to a lot of the other data points that people like to look at, we looked at it and said, are they just scrubbing news releases? And there's really no definition of how they come up with it, and really doesn't really make sense to have this be the topic of the week. And we decided no. It was pretty funny though, reading one of the trying to do some research into the methodology. On some website, basically said that it's not adjusted for seasonal variation and it doesn't distinguish between layoffs scheduled for the short term or the long term, and whether it's just kind of a buy announcement. So really not a data point that really people need to pay attention to. So we'll continue to not pay attention to it, but it was just something on our radar. We also got the jobless claims numbers came out on Thursday. Initial jobless claims came in at 211,000, slightly higher than the 195,000 estimate. Continuing claims similarly higher than estimate at 1.718 million. Most of those increases were due to California and New York. And I did see that given the kind of the snow and the wet weather we've had in here in California over the past few weeks, that they claimed, and this is the kind of the bullish argument, that a lot of those increases were due to that weather, that unseasonably wet weather that we are having here also today. And then this morning, we got the non-farm payroll number a week late, piece of Friday. That number came in higher than expectations at 311,000. It was expected to be 225, so much stronger than consensus. Unemployment rate actually rose from 3.4% to 3.6. Some of that is due to higher participation, which we always say is the good side of a higher unemployment. But also, when we do look back at the overall labor force participation rate, that number actually increased from 62.4 to 62.5, and the prime age cohort of the labor force participation rate returned back to the pre-pandemic highs of 83.1%. So at least that's good news from the labor side of things. The underemployment was also slightly higher, came out at 6.6 last month and 6.8% here for February. And looking at the average hourly earnings numbers, those actually came in slightly lower than expectations. So maybe people were feeling a little bit better about the Fed not increasing rates by 50 basis points there. And it came in at 0.2% positive versus the 0.3% month over month. Kind of moving over to kind of what happened during the week in terms of Fed speak, we did have Jay Powell back-to-back 2 days in front of Congress. Tuesday, he was out in front of the Senate, and Wednesday was in front of the House. On Tuesday, he kind of made the markets move and made headlines when he said, quote, "If the totality of the data were to indicate that faster tightening is warranted, we would be prepared to increase the pace of rate hikes," end quote. Now, some people were saying, well, the pace of rate hikes, they're already raising rates every single meeting. Does he mean that it's an intra-meeting rate hike? That doesn't seem like something they would be doing now as they're kind of closer to the end of the cycle than the beginning. So people interpreted that to mean that they, by increase the pace, that the opening the door for a 50 basis point rate hike here in the March 22nd meeting, that shot up the probability on the Fed funds futures of a 50 basis point rate hike from it was about 30% to over 60% on Tuesday, and actually went over to 70% on Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday, when he was in front of the House, it was pretty much the same thing. He just kind of walked back about a little bit about his 50 basis point rate hike, but that probability of a 70 or a 50 basis point hike remained relatively high until today. We'll get into today in a second, but the Fed also, their blackout period starts tomorrow, so you're not going to hear any Fed commentary. But it'll be interesting to see. Keep an eye on, as we have to say, on Nick Timiraos's Twitter feed to see if he got the call on any sort of Fed moves in terms of whether they're going 25 or 50. Today kind of, I think, changed things a lot. There's a lot of data out there saying, economists saying, pricing in, 311 jobs that we're going to get a 50 basis point rate hike in March. Obviously, everything depends on, we'll front run ourselves a little bit here. Everything depends on the CPI data we get on Tuesday. Assuming CPI comes in as expected, people were still pricing in a 50 basis point rate hike until you got this huge rally in rates today on the back of some maybe financial stability issues. Sam, as you said, the U.S. bank index was down 7.7% on Thursday, and regional banks were down 8%. That's their worst day since June of 2020. We did see the two-year rally from 507 to 487 on that Thursday. And a lot of that just because of this this bank run and the financial stability issues. Now, part of the so for the topic of the week, we're going to talk kind of generally, I would say, about what happened today and over the past couple of days, and similarly, kind of how we view things. And Sam, as we've kind of lived through the on the front lines of 2007-2008 financial crisis, kind of similarities or non-similarities to what was happening back then. But really, when we look at it, part of the reason that you saw Bitcoin down a lot was that you had a different California bank that was that catered to crypto bankers or crypto depositors go under this week, earlier this week. That probably led to a lot of the weakness there in Bitcoin. But we'll see what happens with this other bank that kind of catered towards the venture capitalist side of things. Was taken over by the FDIC earlier this morning. So this bank, it's an interesting case. There's never, as people start talking about what's going on, there's definitely a lot of chatter out there on what's happening, what caused them to go under. You have the conspiracy theorists who were like, They bought a bunch of long duration agency mortgages, which they did, and this is the proof that agency mortgages shouldn't exist. Certainly, we don't fall in that camp. It seems like it was a pretty straightforward bank run. And Sam, I don't know if you wanted to touch on maybe some talk there in the popular media or I guess what used to be the popular media about bank runs. We can kind of get into some a little bit more specifics.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it, when we look at it from the high level, it's just, you mentioned two two banks here. And generally speaking, the commonality, I think, between them were that they did focus on a narrow segment of clientele. I mean, in this case, you mentioned the venture funded startups as well as crypto. So you, what that really translates to is you have a narrow depositor or funding base. So if there is some type of run on this narrowly focused component of the market or of the industry, then perhaps, you know, the flows that do exit through withdrawals are quite chunky and they can be quite large given the clientele here that we're talking about again. And in both cases across there, you saw slowing growth, right? You saw, you definitely see it in the crypto side, but also since the tech market, I guess, has really had kind of a roller coaster ride since the pandemic. You know, they saw a lot of funding in the early days post pandemic, but then really in the last year or so, particularly in 2022, you saw slowing growth there. So both on the tech startup side as well as the venture funding that backed them up. So that perhaps started to lead to some of these, the startup clientele by today's bank failure to start withdrawing their cash deposit from the bank just in order really to support their ongoing daily business ventures. So I think that's somewhat of the commonality there within here. And really to just the idea of meeting these withdrawals, you know, banks were resorted to selling assets, you know, which they had held, which ultimately, given the backdrop of the investment portion of that asset base, that meant they were taking losses. That meant losses going from unrealized to taking realized losses on those asset sales. And in the case of today's bank failure, the assets on that book, I saw that there was something. Someone had put out that there was about 57% of those assets were investment-based versus around 40% with assets or invested assets as kind of the closest high water mark amongst its competitors. So having to kind of take that immediate loss definitely exacerbated the situation as well. And, you know, as we're talking about today, a big part of those invested assets were in interest rate sensitive components such as treasuries and agency mortgage-backed securities. So really what you saw from there stemmed, or you might be seeing the cracks in the financial stability based on central bank policy that we've seen, particularly through the Fed via aggressive monetary policy on rate hikes. I mean, what, we're 4.5% higher on the Fed funds target rate over the course of inside a year. And on top of that, the quantitative tightening. So with that, you know, we've had a little bit of a run on the banks as we're talking about today over the last week or so. And that really seemed to be, at least, you know, for this particular bank, the final nail in the coffin.
Yeah, but I think they were almost they almost were done in by bad timing. And, you know, obviously, as we say, it's not all just one thing, but, you know, they got a lot of deposits in. Back when, you know, QE was going on, there was free money everywhere, which makes sense given their venture capital base. And so they got money in. What are they supposed to do with it? They're not going to buy treasuries that were yielding zero. So they're buying, you know, mortgage-backed securities that had, you know, no credit risk, which is good. You don't want to have too much credit risk on your balance sheet. But they you know, had an average yield of, you know, allegedly, you know, 1.5% or so average yield. So you're still making that 150 basis point, you know, margin there. But, you know, as you know, we experience, and as our listeners experience, and as we talked through last week, you know, given the rate movement in rates, or as we talked about the last year, I guess not last week, given that movement in rates, you know, those mortgages are down 18-20% in terms of price. Now, you know, if they could ride out that wave and not have to sell over the next 30 years, you're going to get par back. So their money good securities is just the, you know, the, taking a huge loss there on the mark to market. And, you know, really when you're looking at it, there then that interest margin goes negative, right? Because you're paying higher rate on your deposit than you're getting on those mortgages. So it makes sense to sell those, you know, small, those negative net interest margin type securities and buy something that has a higher margin. So it makes sense, you know, for them to do that. You don't want to be holding on, you know, you don't want to be bleeding out over time if you can kind of stem the wound and, you know, live to fight another day. But I think that part of their, you know, I guess that, you know, they came out, sold some securities to kind of get some breathing room, which makes sense. But they, you know, then they went out and tried to to raise some capital in the markets, which also makes sense. But you know, when you go out then in your bank and you're raising capital, people always question, is my money safe there? And over the past couple of days, it turned out, or people really came to a place where they were like, you know what, it's not worth. And you know, we certainly agree with that. But they would say it's not worth me keeping my money over the FDIC insurance limit at a bank that you could potentially lose it. And so you know, I've seen varying amounts of what percentage of their deposits are FDIC insured, anywhere from like 3% to 5% to 10%. So in that range, whatever that number is, because it is such a small number relative to a lot of the other banks, they were, you know, subject to kind of that bank run. So when people started to pull their money out and people started talking about it, and, you know, when you're a small, close-knit, you know, supposedly close-knit venture-backed community in the Bay Area, you know, you're talking to people, you're like, yeah, I'm pulling my money out, you know, just like Sam, you and I would talk about, hey, I'm pulling my money out. And you're like, and then you would be like, well, that makes sense. I'm going to go pull my money out. And then you talk to the other people and, you know, that's how you get the good old bank run. And with deposit rates so low, it doesn't really make sense to continue to hold it, your money at a bank there. And if you start looking, you know, you can buy, as we've talked about, you can buy a, or as I saw on Ken Shinoda's Channel 11, you know, T-bill and chill, just buy those T-bills. You know, it's safe. You're earning more yield there. And why don't you just, you know, people would just do that instead. So I think it just kind of, it's a typical bank run, just compounded on itself. And really just came to a place where, you know, and we were talking about how it's interesting, the, you know, normally the FDIC, or at least historically, the FDIC comes in on a Friday night, you know, so like at 1:05 when we started our Twitter spaces, the that's when the FDIC comes in and takes over a bank. But the fact that they did it this morning during market hours really showed that, you know, things were pretty precarious. And you know, things were going to get worse throughout the day, and they couldn't even wait for markets. You couldn't wait the, you know, 5 or 6 hours for markets to close before they had to take it over.
Yeah, and you know, we're talking about this before we started this segment. Just, I mean, prior to 2008, my only visual of a bank run was from that scene in It's a Wonderful Life. But you know, you and I, you know, having worked in downtown LA during the global financial crisis, we were there to, you know, see, remember Washington Mutual? You know, I still have checks, a checkbook from them. I'm just holding on to that thing. But I remember going down to the corner in downtown LA where they had that larger Washington Mutual, which is now a Chase Bank, but seeing people gathered outside. I wouldn't have called it a bank run, but there is definitely a larger line than usual that extended outside of the bank for people looking to withdraw some of their deposits there that in excess. And you know, you're talking about insured versus uninsured. It's important to note too that just because you have insured deposits, it sometimes can the payment of your $250 per insurer per category there can be prolonged at times to get that repayment. But in thinking about this topic, I went to the FDIC's website just to kind of look to see how many, you know, bank failures we've had in the past few years, and pretty much since the pandemic. So let's just say in 2021, 2022, there have been zero failed banks over that failed period of time. But bank failures in themselves aren't that uncommon. You know, going back to 2000 is where they provide the data. There's only been 5 years where there have been zero failures. We were on this last 2 years stretch of having no bank failures, but most years you're going to see a handful or so of failed banks. And you see this, it gets kind of lumpy. It starts to cascade. You know, as we like to say, as Gundlach likes to say, there's never just one cockroach. But looking back to the global financial crisis era, you know, there is a significant ramp up, as one, I guess, would expect. But, you know, let me just kind of rattle some numbers off here. In looks like 2005 and 2006, boom years economically, and then, you know, kind of just in financial markets, those saw zero failures in both of each of those 2 years. And then that went up to three failures in 2007 as problems started to appear. And then in 2008, that jumped up to 25 bank failures. I mean, I mentioned WaMu, but I saw IndyMac on there as well. And I'm sure that's a name that you remember there, Jeff. But then it really started to to move up. Beginning in 2009, there was 140 bank failures as categorized by the FDIC, and then 157 failures in 2010. And then it started to slow in terms of the pace by 2011. It went down to 92 in 2011, 51 in 2012. But it wasn't until 2015 that we started to get to, you know, that handful or so per year, where in 2015 we had 8, followed by 5 in 2016. So definitely, I mean, just based, I'm not drawing a similar, you know, I'm not saying that it's the same situation now, but, you know, these types of things, when they do come up, they, you know, it could be a sign of more to come. In this case, though, I mean, you know, as of right now, it seems like most of the larger banks are well capitalized, but these, you know, these small banks, these regional banks are the ones that people are putting their eyes towards right now in terms of, you know, potential candidates for failure.
That's what I was going to say. Kind of the takeaway here is that, you know, the risks are, you know, there's some regional banks that may people may start to pull their money out of the smaller banks, as I said, banks may need to start to increase, you know, this so much they've been keeping deposit rates so low for so long because they've had an excess of capital that now they may have to start increasing their deposit rates so that they don't at least on the small regional banks, so that they don't get a run on the bank. And that entice people to keep their deposits there, at least moving over to like a money market fund. Jason send over that someone asked us whether they, you know, this bank had to sell all of their treasuries on one day and take a huge loss. We'll note that that overall banks have already been selling their agency MBS over the past half year or so, or I guess probably 9 months or so. They've been doing it kind of opportunistically, selling slightly. These, you know, negative to low net interest margin securities. I think that this bank, the issue wasn't really that they sold all in one day. It was that they tried to raise capital, and that's really what caught people's attention, and that's really what started people to question it. So you kind of were in a catch 22 there, where they needed to raise money, but I think that they needed to raise money, so they tried to. And if they didn't, that would be bad. And if they did, then, you know, or if they put it out, then that will also be bad. So they had to take the way that they thought they could make it out. Certainly, you could start to see some, you know, from the banking side, some margin pressure still again. And that, I guess at the margin, we probably see some a little bit more selling of those lower coupon agency mortgages. That the Fed holds. The Fed holds most of those. So maybe the Fed will pick up some of their buying on those low coupon agency mortgages that the banks hold as a way to back themselves out of this hole. I would note that also we just saw that the Fed is having a meeting, a closed door meeting on Monday at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time. And they're going to talk about the advance and discount rates that are charged by the Federal Reserve banks. Certainly they're discussing it. They're not going to raise those rates. So it seems like they're going to likely cut those rates. It'll be interesting to see, given the blackout period, you're just going to get a press release with that, with no explanation. But as you and I also, Sam, were saying, it's a Monday at 11:30 meeting. It's not a Saturday or Sunday night meeting. So things, they feel right now that things are calm enough that they can take their time, but also not calm enough that they need to have an emergency meeting. So I guess they're in that weird place where they're trying to figure out what's going on. And certainly we're going to get more information over the weekend.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's that the big shock value, you know, and there's some post-traumatic stress syndrome from the unannounced emergency meetings that occur on the weekends. I mean, the most recent being, 3 years ago, you know, now when we're looking at the calendar here. But, you had mentioned that it was an intraday closure of the bank, and that's always, you know, somewhat interesting. But going on, you know, looking at the FDIC site, they basically defined a bank failure as one being when the bank is closed by the federal or state banking regulatory agency, And it's generally closed when the bank is unable to meet its obligations to depositors and others. And that seems pretty straightforward. But I guess, you know, the question for some of the people who do have deposits there are, you know, wondering about their own banks if they're a little bit concerned there. In the event of a bank failure, the FDIC really acts in two ways. First, as the insurer of bank deposits, they pay the insurance back to the depositors up to that insurance limit. And really on that, as I mentioned before, it can be quite long at time. I mean, depends on how quickly they'll pay out. But what the FDIC posted on their website today is that they will be paying those depositors who have up to the insured amount. They'll be paying them no later than this coming Monday morning, so March 13th there. As for the uninsured portion, the FDIC as the receiver, because this bank did go into receivership, as its role as a receiver, the Fed assumes the task of selling and basically disposing of the remaining assets of the failed bank, and then first settling its debts to creditors, and then it settles the remaining in of the uninsured deposit amounts, and it'll start to settle those claims for those deposits. So, and the way it does that is they'll first, again, this is part is mentioned on the website through the press release on the FDIC. They say they'll begin to pay uninsured depositors an unspecified amount within the next week, up to again that unspecified amount. But then thereafter, whatever remains, the uninsured depositors will instead just receive a receivership certificate for that remaining amount of their uninsured funds. So that kind of sounds like an IOU. And kind of by the sound of what, you know, we've been talking about here, there's going to be a lot of IOUs there for the uninsured portion.
Yeah. And this is why I think they usually try to get someone to take over the bank, right? When, you know, they try to take, you know, when Chase bought Washington Mutual, you know, or took it over at pennies on the dollar. That's really what they, you know, that's really what the government or the FDIC wants you to do, because you don't have to wait and get these receivership. What did you call? I don't remember what you called them.
Get the IOUs.
Yeah. So you don't want to get those. You want to be able to take your money out. And so it sounds like you know, people on Monday, whether they, you know, I did see some Twitter videos about people waiting out line outside the bank today and not being able to get their money out of the bank today, which makes sense given that they were closed down this morning, but that they should be able to get their money out on Monday. And I would say that there's probably gonna be a long line if you're going in person to get your money out on Monday, even though it's guaranteed and if everything should be okay by then. I think it's gonna, you know, you burn me once and you know, don't get burned twice on that.
Yeah. So again, this is the first bank failure since, I want to say, October of 2020, but at least since the first one since 2020, after the stretch of zero bank failures in 2020 and 2021. So let's keep an eye on this. We'll keep listeners apprised of the situation in terms of how it develops. And also, we'll keep the running count, I guess. We'll start looking to see as we meet hurdles within this FDIC failed bank list.
Yeah, usually you just don't notice them, or obviously if you're banking with them, you'd notice them, but doesn't take over the market commentary or the, you know, the treasury markets like it did today. Also wanted to highlight that Ken Shinoda put out a piece with some good charts there. Head over to our Twitter, D-Line Channel 11. And he's got a pretty good write up there that we cribbed off of a lot of what he pulled there.
Yep.
With that, we want to get a move to things to keep an eye on next week, other than bank runs and bank fails.
Yeah. So on Tuesday, we've got a big data print coming out, potentially market moving, likely market moving. We have the CPI data for the month of February. And with that, the expectations are for month over month CPI on the headline basis to continue to accelerate. It's estimated to be a 0.4%, down from 0.5, but still a positive number, a positive sign in front of there. On the headline basis, it's also expected to increase on a month over month basis by 40 basis points, in line with the prior month of January. on a year-over-year basis, headline is estimated to slow down its rate of growth here at 6%, down from 6.4% the month prior. And core CPI on a year-over-year basis is expected to grow at 5.5%.
Yeah, I'm disappointed that Bloomberg doesn't have a, and the economists don't have their estimate for the super core.
To see. Not yet. I guess that's something that we can keep an eye on for the future there, but wouldn't be surprised if that starts rounding the estimates here as well. The next day on Wednesday, March 15th, we get the producer price indices. As we've talked about in the past, this sometimes can be a leader to the consumer price baskets, as these are the input prices that producers pay to manufacture goods and services there. And provide services there. So on the headline basis, it's expected to accelerate by 30 basis points on a month over month basis. Core is expected to be higher by 40 basis points on a month over month. This leads to a positive 5.4% estimate for the headline year over year and a 5.2% year over year estimated for core PPI. Also on Wednesday, we have another important data point that I think the FOMC will be paying attention to. That is retail sales, as that gives a gauge on the strength of the U.S. consumer. The numbers here are expected to decelerate with the headline expected to slow down on a month-over-month basis to a negative 0.3%, as is the core group at negative 0.3%. So perhaps a little bit of a reprieve there, something for Jay Powell and his cohort to take a look at. And then finally, we do have something that you and I, we don't usually pay attention to, but since Jay Powell had referenced it a few times in his Q&A during the FOMC meetings, the University of Michigan sentiment indicators, as well as the inflation indicators. We don't have the estimates for the inflation, but last time it had slowed down to a rate of 2.9%. The reason we don't really pay attention to these as much is because they're surveys based on kind of a finger wagging in the air to see what the direction of inflation might be 5 to 10 years out. But since Jay again references it, we do take note of it. We'll see what that number comes out to be next Friday, and we'll talk about it then.
Well, it depends on how he's feeling, whether he's going to do 50 or 25, and whether he wants to discuss it or not.
That's right. So a lot of key information coming out in a Fed blackout week on the back of some bank runs going on. So it could be an exciting week. I think it will be next week in markets.
Yeah, hopefully less exciting than today. You know, it's a very interesting day, kind of brought back a lot of feelings of 3 years ago and, you know, 15, 16, 17 years ago now.
That's right.
Well, I mean, I guess that wraps it up for this week, Sam. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks, everyone, for listening to us today, both on the podcast, if you're listening to this a little bit late, or on Twitter Spaces, if you're choosing to listen to us live. Please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can find us on the podcast platforms at pretty much all your favorite ones, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify. If you have any questions, comments, or if you want to submit a question or a topic for Mayberry and I to dive into for the topic of the week, you can hit us up on email at minutes@doubleline.com or on the Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Yeah, just you can just tap, if you're those of you listening, just tap them and tap the little icons and then click follow. You remember to go to our website, doubleline.com, YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. You can watch a double shot of Ken Shinoda. He has his monthly market update titled Beware the Noise, which I thought was very interesting. Also, he's got a new Channel 11 interview with Chris Flanagan on fixed income and securitized credit. Don't forget to, as I said, click on the Sherman Show button there. Those of you listening live and follow Sam and Jeff Sherman on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. We'll be back again next week, likely earlier during market hours because it's an unofficial holiday next week. So hope everyone has a great week and a great weekend.
Yeah, official holiday for us here, at least with me and you, Jeff, for St. Paddy's Day. But thanks, everyone, and good luck out there.
The presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.